This week in our philosophy class, which we could perhaps call the new Brahmajala Sutta, discussion of the 62 kinds of views of the heretics. I'm going to have a look at the ideas of David Hume. No, that's another Hume. Yeah, that's a Hume who was an Australian something. A governor or something like that. Yeah. Different Hume. Explorer. Right? David Hume lived from 1711 to 1776. So think about it, he died in 1776, so that means in 1976 was 200 years later. So from his birth...
I was 36. I was born in 1976.
Are you born in 1976?
Yes, 36 years
past. Okay, excellent. Okay, so from 1711, which is more or less now, so that's like born 300 years ago. So you kind of get that into perspective. So he's out, like we last week we looked at Descartes, so Hume is later than Descartes. 1700s, what was happening in 1700s? Wars, yeah, pretty much, yeah. Okay, was a Scottish philosopher. Slightly chubby one, apparently. Economist and essayist, known especially for his philosophical empiricism and skepticism. Okay, so we've discussed the term empiricism before, and empiricism is essentially the idea that knowledge should remain close to the senses and can be contrasted with what's sometimes called the metaphysical approach. And for example, Descartes had skepticism about the senses, like the sense can lead you astray. So you have this strand of Western philosophy which you can trace back to Socrates, where he believed that reason can provide us with a kind of knowledge which is more sure than what's found through the senses. And it's not a completely bizarre idea. I mean, for example, the great paradigm of that is geometry. So you can work out from geometry, if you know the length of the sides of a square, for example, if I know a square is exactly 10 centimetres long, has sides exactly 10 centimetres long, then I can work out exactly the area of that square without any doubt or ambiguity. However, if I'm presented with an actual square, then there'll always be a bit of fudge room, won't it? There's always the knowledge was always a bit fuzzy around the edges. You can never measure it exactly. So this is this idea that actual truth can only be arrived at through reason. And David Hume is one of the best known philosophers who criticized that idea and said that, on the contrary, that reason is secondary to experience. And as such, I believe that in that respect he is very close in some aspects to Buddhist philosophy. And not only in his methodology, but also in some of the conclusions that he reached are remarkably similar to some of the ideas we find in Buddhism. He's one of the most important figures in the history of Western philosophy and the Scottish Enlightenment. There you go, he didn't know Scotland was enlightened. Hume is often grouped with John Locke, George Berkeley, and a handful of others as a British empiricist. Beginning with his A Treatise of Human Nature, which we'll look at a bit later on, Hume strove to create a total naturalistic science of man that examined the psychological basis of human nature. So notice this terminology, it's naturalistic, it's a psychological basis. In stark opposition to the rationalists who preceded him, most notably Descartes, he concluded that desire, rather than reason, governed human behaviour, saying reason is and ought only be the slave of the passions. Okay? And, you know, also that's, I think, something which has a strong resonance in the Buddhist philosophy, that desire, in a way, is much more fundamental. I mean, you can see that if you look at the natural world, for example, yeah, that animals obviously have desires and passions, but they don't have reason. A prominent figure in the skeptical philosophical tradition and a strong empiricist, he argued against the existence of innate ideas, concluding instead that humans have knowledge only of things they directly experience. So notice how this is relevant to that discussion I was talking about before. If you discount the evidence of the senses and you say we can arrive at the truth through reason only, then how is it that you get these ideas in reason? So for example, if you take the example I mentioned before of in geometry of a square, how do you get the notion of a square, right? We define a square as a two-dimensional object whose sides are a line and where all four sides are the same length, yeah, and they're all 90 degree angles. So where have we got these ideas of a two-dimensional object, of a line, of a 90 degree angle, and so on? Are these things which are somehow inherent in our mind, or are they things that we've inferred from experience? If they're things that are inferred from experience in the first place, then they, if a rationalist is trying to persuade us that experience is unreliable, then such geometric proofs themselves would be unreliable. So the idea of innate ideas is also, it's also something which, in a sense, although not directly, but in a sense, is kind of appropriate within a theistic tradition. You know, it's the idea that sort of God has put certain things in your head. You know, that you have an innate idea that lines are straight or something like that. Thus, he divides perceptions between strong and lively impressions or direct sensations and fainter ideas which are copied from impressions. Okay, now this is very similar to the distinction which I've talked about on several occasions. In Buddhism, you have a distinction between the the direct perception, or pratyaksha in Pali, pratyaksha in Sanskrit, pratyaksha, what's before your eyes. Okay, so what's directly perceived through the senses. So this is what Hume calls the impressions. And then there's the anumana, which is the inference, which is those things copied from impressions, which is fainter. So for Hume, as opposed to Descartes or Socrates, the products of the mind are less real, less vivid than the impressions, that is, the sense objects themselves. So when we're looking through Hume's work, don't neglect to bear this in mind. This is very important to understand how Hume is using these words. Yeah? Impressions means direct sense objects, and ideas means the inferential concepts derived from those impressions, from those direct sense objects. He developed the position that mental behavior is governed by custom. Our use of induction, for example, is justified only by our idea of the constant conjunction of causes and effects. Okay, so who knows what induction is? No, it's not talking about electricity.
Yeah, I thought it was
electricity.
Is
it a difference? Yeah. Yes.
Deduction.
Okay, in induction is contrasted with deduction. Abduction is again different. Okay, so in logic, then we have two kinds of reasoning, deduction and induction. We'll come to deduction first. Is the process of reasoning from one or more general statements regarding what is logically what is known to reach a logically certain conclusion. So again, notice how this is relating to that idea that I was talking about before. Can we reach logically certain conclusions merely by reasoning about them? Okay, so I can conclude, for example, if I have a square, again to use that same example, a square of 10 centimeter long sides, that is going to have an area of such and such, an area of what, 100 square centimeters? Right? And that's a deductive reasoning. It must be the case because it's defined in that way. So here's an example, the classic example of a deductive argument. All men are mortal. Principle number one. Sounds reasonable enough. So, not men. Well, if you were to say all women are mortal, or all persons are mortal, is another example. But even if you take men as being all humans or as all male humans, in both cases the first proposition stands. Yeah? So it doesn't actually affect it. Socrates is a man. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So this is the cliched example of a deductive argument. The first premise states that all objects classified as men have the attribute mortal. The second premise states that Socrates is classified as a man, a member of the set men. The conclusion then states that Socrates must be mortal because he inherits this attribute from his classification as a man. Deductive reasoning, also known as logical deduction, links premises with conclusions. If both premises are true, the terms are clear and the rules of deductive logic are followed, then the conclusion of the argument follows by logical necessity. I won't go in there any further, but I just want you to tell me what's wrong with that argument. Just make it personal, okay? That's going to make it easier for you. Deductive reasoning in the age... We could do a paper on that. Deductive reasoning in the age of gender studies. No.
Is it lack of evidence regarding the first premise?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Meaning what?
There seem to be some functions built into it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And this, I think, is the huge problem with deductive arguments, that it sounds like it's actually proving something. It sounds like you're getting more knowledge out of it than you had at the beginning, right? That's the point. I mean, if you can't learn anything from it, then why bother doing it? But in fact, it's not. In fact, you've just assumed this in your first statement, all men are mortal. How do you know all men are mortal? Have you asked them all? Have you seen them all? There's 7 billion people alive today. Hey, maybe we're all going to get infected with a zombie virus and we're not going to die. So we don't know whether we're going to be mortal or not. So this is just something which actually it sounds plausible enough to make that kind of generalization. But in fact, it's just an assertion, really. And we've come from that assertion, that sort of well-meaning and plausible enough assertion, and we believe that we've generated knowledge by the deductive process, whereas in fact all that we're doing is kind of drawing something out of our hats. The fact is that the last sentence is more certain than the first sentence, right? We've actually got better reason to think Socrates is mortal. We know that he died, right? We've got better reason to think that than we have to believe that all men are mortal, right? Actually, there's plenty of stories where some men become immortal, right? We could say we don't believe any of them, that's fine, but nobody says that Socrates is immortal. So we've actually got that last sentence is already on better grounds than the first one. So it's creating an impression that we've learned something by this deductive process, whereas in fact, we haven't learned anything at all. So this, I think, is the basic problem with deductive reasoning, is that it sounds like it's producing knowledge, whereas in fact, it's just hiding its inferences in its premises. And I would argue, in fact, that all reasoning is inductive.
I just bought the assumption that it's just sort of part of the course. It doesn't necessarily make it more useful.
What's part of the course?
There's, you start assuming A, assuming B,
yeah,
and assuming A and B, then C.
Yeah.
There's not a same as H. It's consciously assuming.
It's consciously assuming, yeah. Which it can be, yeah, it can be. And by consciously assuming you're still learning something about how logic works,
yeah.
He's telling you something about how the internal workings of it go, that's fair enough. But the problem is, I think, that actually we don't keep that conscious.
Yeah.
Yeah? We assume that the classic example of when the two economists fell down a pit. Yeah? Two economists fell down a pit and they're down at the bottom and there's like this, you know, huge slide, they can't slide, climb up the sides and there's no way out and they're going, and one of them says, this is it, we're going to die here, and the other one says, no, I've got a solution. He says, what is it? Well, he said, first, assume we have a ladder. Which is pretty much the basis of all economics theory.
I think you first run a bit, observation.
From observing all men?
Yeah, it is your observation. It can be like a contemplation of that in Buddhism, one kind of meditation.
So you've observed all men, have you?
Yeah. No, not of the all men, but we know that our grandfather died,
Right, which is an inductive argument, it's not deductive. Yeah? So this is purely the point that I'm making is that I'm not trying to say that it's not true and it's not reasonable and all those things, but it's merely that it sounds like it's self-evident, whereas in fact that first premise itself is the product of an inductive reasoning. And this is one of David Hume's points in his philosophy. So inductive reasoning, just having another quick look at that, is a kind of reasoning that constructs or evaluates propositions that are abstractions of observations of individual instances of members of the same class. Inductive reasoning contrasts with deductive reasoning in that a general conclusion is arrived at by specific examples. Okay, so the deductive arrives at something specific starting with something general, all men are mortal, and arrives at one example of that class is the conclusion. Whereas inductive reasoning starts with particular examples and then infers, it draws conclusions based on that. So inductive reasoning actually is much more closer to the way that the Buddha used reasoning. And inductive reasoning doesn't aim at producing an absolute truth, but merely at producing probabilistic statements. Okay? So here's an example. All of the swans that we have seen are white, therefore all swans are white. Okay? So that kind of inductive reasoning is very common, isn't it? Yeah? We've only seen examples of that. All giraffes have spots. Right? Of course, this being a classic one historically, when they came to Australia, then they found black swans.
Australia.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right.
Except Australia.
That's fair enough, yeah. Okay, a better example of inductive reasoning is as follows. All of the swans that all living beings have ever seen are white, therefore all swans are white. Although that's perhaps saying it's a proper example, but how do you know what all living beings have ever seen? That's another kind of...
It's not actually very correct. If you were to say all of the swans that those we have consulted have seen have been recorded to be white, therefore there is a good chance that all swans are white, but you can't do that.
That's right, and that's the principle that you should remain close to your facts. Carl Sagan put it that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And that's actually derived from one of the principles that David Hume used. He didn't actually say that exactly, but he said very similar kinds of statements. He says a wise man proportions their conclusions to the evidence available to them. Something like that. In other words, that you don't that you're conservative in how far beyond the evidence that you move. Now, this is something that we've seen repeatedly when we're looking at the suttas. For example, Mahakama Vibhanga Sutta, we looked at a couple of weeks ago. You know, somebody has psychic powers, they see someone dying and being reborn. They say, oh, well, therefore, everybody gets died and reborn in that way, the same thing will happen to them. And that's precisely this problem of inductive reasoning which is happening there. It's rushing to reach too much conclusion based on insufficient evidence. Okay, so so David Hume developed the position that mental behaviour is governed by custom. For example, so this is very close to the Buddhist idea of panyati, or conventions, but also close to the Buddhist idea of what they call asevana, basic 24 pachayas, 24 conditions in the Patana is called asevana pachaya, which means the condition where things reinforce each other by being constantly done again and again. And so the Buddha, of course, always talking about this notion of training, of doing something again and again and again to train your mind in that way. So this is something that Hume also was pointing towards, again contrasting with that Western tradition, which tended to assume that the mind is somehow given, and that when you come to certain conclusions, it's because that's naturally what happens when minds are in that way. Whereas David Hume was pointing much more to this idea that the mind is conditioned. And so in that sense, he's moving towards a much more psychologically based philosophy, and thus providing you know, some of the philosophical foundations for the later development of psychology. So, for example, our use of induction is justified only by our idea of the constant conjunction of causes and effects. Okay, so this is one of Hume's, perhaps his most controversial philosophical arguments, and one which is still debated and controversial in modern philosophy. And he tended to, and whether he exactly meant this is debatable, but he tended to argue that whereas we think of something as being caused by something else, all we can actually observe is the conjunction of things. One thing happens and another thing happens. And the notion that something has caused the other thing is merely an idea which we've got in our mind. In Hume's term, it's an idea rather than an impression. The impressions all we can perceive through our senses, is one thing happens and then another thing happens. And so we don't actually perceive causation. We merely, it's merely an idea which we've conjured up. Without direct impressions of a metaphysical itself, again, this is exactly the same argument that the Buddha used, when you come to this idea of impression, that is sense perception, you can never actually directly perceive a self, a single solitary unifying basis for identity. He concluded that humans have no actual conception of the self, only of a bundle of sensations associated with the self. Or whether there is any self at all, but all we perceive is a bundle of sensations. So in these kinds of ideas, he's remarkably close to many Buddhist ideas. I'll come back to that in a minute. Hume advocated a compatibilist theory of free will that proved extremely influential in subsequent moral philosophy. He was also a sentimentalist who held that ethics are based on feelings rather than abstract moral principles. By saying he's a sentimentalist, it's a philosophical sentimentalist. It doesn't mean that he was kind of weepy and liked writing maudlin poetry or something like that. It just means that he believes that we make ethical choices based on our feelings or our instincts or our passions rather than on abstract reasoning. Hume also examined the normative is-ought problem. Okay, so the is-ought problem is a problem in philosophy which is can you derive an ought from an is? In other words, can you derive a moral statement about what should be from a factual statement about what actually is in the world? Right? So this being again, if you come this being typically this is a the conjunction there between theism and modern philosophy tends to be like from a theistic point of view, God created the world, and so the ought is sort of built into the world. How things should be is part of the moral fabric of the world is built into it. Whereas other philosophers, Hume and subsequent philosophers, have tended to say that the world just is as it is. It's just it's value free, and that the moral values is purely our own psychological judgment about the world. It's subjective. It does not something that actually exists in the world as it is. And then, of course, being a framework which underlies the development of modern science, where you try to be as value-free as possible. You know, you throw all the values out the door. Of course, the problem with that is if you conceive of the problem on an ontological level and say, do moral values exist in the world? And then you say, well, no, they don't. Therefore, we should get them out of the way and investigate the problem being free from judging about them. Then that sounds kind of reasonable enough, but the problem is that that which does the investigation always has moral values, yeah, which is, in other words, a human mind, which is doing the investigation. So the moral values are always there, whether you like it or not, whether they exist objectively in the world or not, they're always there in an inquiry. He held notoriously ambiguous views of Christianity. So the time that Hume was living, it still wasn't particularly popular to announce that you were an atheist. Notice he's living after Descartes, so Descartes sort of made these steps, even though Descartes believed in God and so on, but Descartes is moving towards this idea of saying, well, we can find out the truth for ourselves. Hume, although he's critical of some aspects of Descartes, he's continuing that aspect. And so notice that after Hume's time, so say the late 17th century, the late 1700s, then in the 1800s, then you started to get the real kind of emergence of a major force in the intellectual class who were quite overtly and even quite aggressively atheist, people like Freud, Marx, and so on and so forth. And so Hume was very much laying some of the groundwork for that, even though when I studied philosophy, they said that a lot of people suspect that he was actually an atheist, but he wasn't prepared to sort of come out and say so in public. He famously challenged the argument from design in his dialogues concerning natural religion. The argument from design is the argument that the world, basically it's the intelligent design argument. Yeah? It's basically the idea that something as complex as the world must have been designed by somebody with intelligence. Kant credited Hume with waking him up from his dogmatic slumbers, and Hume has proved extremely influential on subsequent philosophy, especially on utilitarianism, logical positivism. William James, okay, so he's an outstanding introducer of the idea of empiricism into psychology. Philosophy of science, only analytic philosophy, cognitive philosy, and other movements and thinkers. The philosopher Jerry Fodor proclaimed Hume's treatise the founding document of cognitive science. Also famous as a prose stylist, Hume pioneered the essay as a literary genre and engaged with contemporary intellectual luminaries such as Rousseau, Adam Smith, kind of basically the founder of capitalism and economics, James Boswell, Joseph Butler, and Thomas Reed.
Does this mean he's the father of the
Balaam? I believe so, yeah.
How do you say there were no essays before? There weren't people publishing tracts?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure exactly what it means there. Yeah. Okay, a little bit of background. Originally David Home, son of Joseph Home of Chernside, advocate, and Catherine Faulkner, was born on 26th of April 1711 in a tenement on the north side of Lawnmarket in Edinburgh. Changed his name in 1734 because the English had difficulty pronouncing Home in the Scottish manner. It's because of the great vowel shift. Through his life, Hume, who never married, spent time occasionally at his family home in Ninewells by Chernside in Berwickshire. Attended the University of Edinburgh at the unusually early age of 12, possibly as young as 10, at a time when 14 was considered normal. At first he considered Korean law, but came to have, in his words, an insurmountable aversion to everything but the pursuits of philosophy and general learning. While my family fancied I was poring over Voet, and Vinius, Cicero, and Virgil were the authors I was secretly devouring. He had little respect for the professors of his time, telling a friend in 1735, "There is nothing to be learnt from a professor which is not to be met with in books." Hume made a philosophical discovery that opened up to him a new scene of thought, which inspired him to throw up every other pleasure or business to apply entirely to it. He did not recount what this scene was, and commentators have offered a variety of speculations. Due to this inspiration, Hume set out to spend a minimum of 10 years reading and writing. He came to the verge of nervous breakdown, after which he decided to have a more active life to better continue his learning. Curious. Made a philosophical discovery. What is the scene that he's talking about? So, as you see, you know, with all of these philosophers and so on, you know, it's not just it's not just something that you do because you kind of, you know, think about it occasionally on the weekend. You know, I mean, for these guys, these things were, there was a passionate commission. It's all that he was interested in his whole life, was trying to understand more. And, you know, 10 years just reading and writing until he comes to the edge of a nervous breakdown, the intensity of that inquiry into what he's doing. Hume's options lay between a travelling tutorship and a stool in a merchant's office. He chose the latter. After a few months occupied with commerce in Bristol, he went to France, where he had frequent discourse with the Jesuits at the College of La Fleche, whatever that is there. As he spent most of his savings during his 4 years there while writing a treatise of human nature, he resolved to make a very rigid frugality, supply my deficiency of fortune, to maintain unimpaired my independency, and regard every object as contemptible except the improvements of my talents in literature. He completed the treatise at the age of 26. He started it at the age of 16. The many scholars today consider the treatise to be Hume's most important work and one of the most important books in Western philosophy. The critics in Great Britain at the time did not agree, describing it as abstract and unintelligible. Despite the disappointment, Hume later wrote, "Being of a natural, cheerful and sanguine temperature, I soon recovered from the blow and prosecuted with great ardour my studies in the country." There he wrote the abstract, and so he wrote a number of different works. He applied for a chair at the University of Edinburgh. He was petitioned not to be appointed because they thought he was an atheist. He tutored the Marquis of Annandale, who was officially described as a lunatic. Yes. Then he started his historical work, The History of England, and various other things.
What happened when he was accused of heresy?
Hume was charged with heresy, but he was defended by his young clerical friends, who argued that, as an atheist, he was outside the church's jurisdiction. It's a bit like the bhikkhunis in Thailand, isn't it? Yeah. Despite his acquittal, Hume failed to gain the chair of philosophy at the University of Glasgow. I don't think he ever actually had a successful post in a university. Okay, so I'm going for too much 30 years. James Boswell saw Hume a few weeks before his death, which was from some form of abdominal cancer. Hume told him he sincerely believed it a most unreasonable fancy that there might be life after death. So, the historian. Okay, so let's have a look at some of David Hume's arguments. I just want to have a look, first of all, though, at the idea that Hume might have had some knowledge of Buddhism. I mean, the connection between Hume's ideas and Buddhist ideas is so profound in certain respects that many people have commented on this and have wondered whether this was... Most people have assumed that it's simply reaching similar conclusions from an inquiry. But this paper here by Alison Gopnik suggests that Hume could have known about Buddhism through his connection with the Royal College of, and again, if anybody wants to tell me how that's supposed to be pronounced, I'm most
flesh.
La Flesh, is that right? The College of La Flesh. Probably sounds like something that it isn't. I would guess. The Jesuit College of La Flesh. Anyway. So this is quite interesting from a historical point of view, you know, to look at these questions of influence and so on. So the abstract of this, okay, let's have a look at the article. Both philosophers and Buddhist scholars have long noted the affinities between David Hume's empiricism and the Buddhist philosophical tradition. The conventional wisdom, however, has been that these affinities must either be a result of an independent conversion or of a general oriental influence on 18th century philosophy and letters. This is because little was known in Buddhism about Buddhism in the Europe of the 1730s when Hume was writing A Treatise of Human Nature. Buddhism had died out in India, Japan was closed to the West, and European scholars in the Chinese court focused on the elite Confucian and Taoist traditions. Buddhism in the West has a curious history, but one of the curious facts about it is that there were actually a few detailed and accurate accounts which were available in the West from this early period, or even earlier, but they more or less sort of remained unread. They were brought back by missionaries and so on, and just sort of remained in a university library or something and didn't have much impact. So even though they might have been available, they didn't have much impact until probably the time of Schopenhauer in the 19th century. I'll show how it was, in spite of this, it was possible for Hume to have had contact with Buddhist philosophical views. The link to Buddhism comes through the Jesuit scholars at the Royal College of La Flèche. Hume lived in La Flèche from 1735 to 1737 and wrote the treatise there. In particular, Charles Francois Dolu was a Jewish missionary who'd lived at the Royal College in La Flèche from 1823 to 1740, overlapping with Hume's stay. He was a sophisticated and well-travelled man who had extensive knowledge both of other religions and cultures and of scientific ideas. Dolu had had first-hand experience with Theravada Buddhism as part of the second French embassy to Siam in 1687 to 1688. Okay, so he was staying there in the town and having frequent conversations with the Jesuits, one of whom had been on a French embassy to Thailand. Buddhism was the official religion of Thailand, and members of the assembly interacted extensively. Interacted extensively with the monks, with the Buddhists, perhaps. The European name for Siamese Buddhists. In 1729, just 8 years before Hume's visit, Dolo had also talked with Ippolito Desideri, a very important figure in Buddhist history, a Jesuit missionary who'd visited Tibet and made an extensive study of Tibetan Buddhism from 1716 to 1721. Desideri studied the Lamrim Chenmo of Tsongkhapa, one of the central figures of Tibetan Buddhist philosophy. Desideri's unpublished book describing Tibet was one of the most extensive and accurate accounts of Buddhist philosophy until the 20th century. So he went there all this way, studied for 5 years, learnt Tibetan and studied Tsongkhapa, and then his book just remained unread when he came back. Dolu and Desideri were part of a network of philosophically, culturally and scientifically knowledgeable Jesuits with connections to both La Flèche and Asia. And they included Jean Venance of Beauchet, the notable Hindu scholar, Jean Richard and Jean Fontenay, distinguished astronomers who made discoveries in India and China, and Joachim Boisberg, who was a mathematical advisor to the Chinese emperor, okay, and corresponded with Leibniz. I mean, isn't that cool, right? You're living in France, corresponding with Leibniz, and the mathematical advisor to the Chinese emperor. There is increasing recognition of the mutual influence between European and Asian intellectual traditions in the early modern period. The story of Hume and the Jesuits suggests that there could have been contact between Buddhist ideas and one of the founding fathers of the European Enlightenment. The story is also interesting as a case study in the complexities of determining philosophical influence. Within the history of philosophy, influence is often seen as a matter of explicit argumentation and persuasion between philosophers with different positions. We can outline, say, Descartes' view on identity and compare them point for point with Hume's, or for that matter, Parfit's or Tsongkhapa's. The picture is of a sort of a grand philosophical colloquium conducted in the Elysian fields among the dead giants of the past. From a purely philosophical point of view, such exercises can be very informative and illuminating. From a psychological, historical and causal point of view, however, influence may be rather different. We know that psychologically people can be influenced by ideas even if they themselves forget the source of those ideas. In fact, this source amnesia is the rule rather than the exception. Information about sources is actually encoded in a different kind of memory, autobiographical or episodic memory, by ideas or facts themselves are stored in a more robust semantic memory. We know listeners can be influenced by ideas even when they're not advocated by the people who present them. Psychologically arguing against a position as well as arguing for it can lead your interlocutor to encode and remember that position. Even great philosophers are not only influenced by other great philosophers, they may pick up ideas from much more obscure figures who happen to be the people they find congenial or talk with on a regular basis, the equivalent of the guy in the next office.
Which actually on that part also underscores the importance of the Buddhist advice about who we hang out with, who we take to be good friends to look up to.
So I won't go into discussing to detail with the thing, but the basic point of this essay, which you can find online if you're interested in it, is that there's no explicit evidence in favour of this, but Hume does talk about specific conversations with learned Jesuits and so on. So there's certainly not unreasonable to suppose that there might be direct or indirect influence there. Okay, so here's a bit of historical information, which is quite interesting. This is talking about the Jesuit embassy to Thailand, which happened earlier. It talks about the Jesuits interacted extensively with the Talapoins, again, the European term for the Siamese Theravada Buddhist monks. I'm not sure what that word is, but it might be related to the word the Tala, the palm leaf manuscripts, Dalabot. Was it in Thai? Is Dunlabot, is that right? The what's the word for the palm leaf manuscripts?
I'm not sure.
Isn't it Dunlabot?
Maybe.
I think it might be Dunlabot. In that case, I think it might be related to the word for the manuscript. Anyway. In fact, three of the Jesuits, including Boucher, lived in the Buddhist monastery and followed its rules in order to learn the official language of the court. So quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah, you've got these Jesuit monks in the 1700s living in a Thai wat. The monastery was close to the official house of the remaining Jesuits, and the fathers living with the monks visited the others every day. It's likely that their reports contributed to Le Beau's account of Siamese religion. He says that the second volume of his book, which contains descriptions of Siamese religion, linguistics, mathematics, natural history and astronomy, and includes translations from Pali, the language of Theravada texts. So I won't go into any more with that, but there's just a sort of interesting little historical detail. So the upshot of that is it's certainly possible that David Hume had some interaction with the Buddhist ideas. Now, I want to actually have a look at some of the David Hume's actual writings. This is from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. The first line of it is, "The most important philosopher ever to write in English." David Hume. I can, but we're not going to be looking at that one. So, yeah. So the Treatise of Human Nature, which he started when he was 16. Let's have a bit of a look at the Treatise of Human Nature and the different parts of it. Nature ideas. Okay, so the nature of ideas. Sorry, I just want to find the. Okay, so let's have a look at some of Hume's arguments in his own words. Okay, so part one of his treatise on human nature, ideas, the origin, composition, connection, abstraction, etc., the origin of our ideas. All the perceptions of the human mind, says Hume, I'm just trying to get this line properly on the screen, fall into two distinct kinds, which I shall call impressions and ideas. These differ in their degrees of force and liveliness with which they strike upon the mind and make their way into our thought or consciousness. The perceptions that enter with most force and violence we may name impressions, and under this name I bring all our sensations, passions and emotions as they make their first appearance in the soul. Okay, so here Hume is using soul to mean mind. It doesn't have a religious implication. We have the same usage in Descartes. By ideas, I mean the faint images of the others in thinking and reasoning. For example, all the perceptions aroused by your reading this book, apart from the perceptions arising from sight and touch, and apart from the immediate pleasure or uneasiness your reading may cause in you. I don't think I need to say much to explain this distinction. Everyone will readily perceive for himself the distance between feeling, impressions, and thinking, ideas. The usual degrees of intensity of these are easily distinguished, though there may be some particular instances where they come close to one another. Thus, in sleep, in a fever, in a madness, or in any very violent emotions of soul, our ideas may become like our impressions. As, on the other hand, it sometimes happens. So the point here is making that, for example, if you're in a dream, and normally we can distinguish very clearly between, say, a sound which has happened externally, and if we imagined internally ourselves, say, the sound of a song that we've heard, yeah, we know the difference between that very clearly. Whereas in a dream, of course, you can get confused between that. It can be a sound in a dream, but actually you realize that it's become because somebody's been playing the song, and that's how it's come into your dream. So you can confuse those in some cases, but usually you can't. Very much so, And also notice just the method he's starting from is epistemological, right? The first thing he wants to establish is how do we know things? But although ideas and impressions are fairly similar in a few cases, they are in general so very different that no one can hesitate to classify them as different and to give to each a special name to mark the difference. Another division of our perceptions should be noted. This one cuts across the line between impressions and ideas. It is the division into simple and complex. Simple perceptions, that is, simple impressions and ideas. So notice he's using perceptions to include both impressions and ideas. Again, just to notice his own sort of idiosyncratic vocabulary here. So simple perceptions are ones that don't allow any distinction or separation among their parts. Complex perceptions, on the contrary, can be distinguished into parts. Though a particular color, taste, and smell are qualities all united together in this apple, it's easy to perceive that they aren't the same as one another and can at least be distinguished from one another, and so on. Total perception of the apple is complex. Having through these divisions ordered and arranged our subject matter perceptions, we can now set to ourselves to consider more accurately their qualities and relations. The first fact that springs to my attention is that our impressions greatly resemble our ideas in every respect except their degree of force and liveliness. Is that true? Our impressions resemble our ideas? I mean, in some cases it is. I mean, if you perceive, if you see with your eyes the colour blue, and then you close your eyes and imagine the colour blue, then that's quite similar. Yeah? But there are other kinds of ideas which don't seem to have any closely, say the idea of democracy, for example. It's not something that's very closely related to any particular sense impression, is it?
Actually, with democracy, what do you see?
Sorry?
You think of democracy, what do you see?
I don't really see anything when I think of democracy.
You don't think of politics and people making agreements and...
Oh, I could if I wanted to. If I wanted to ask myself the question, think of democracy and imagine what image comes into mind, then I could. But if I normally just thought of democracy, I wouldn't have any particular image in my mind.
The impression is going to say, with the example of democracy, that... the feeling that it's the right thing, that there's a sense of
this. Maybe. Maybe. He did talk about that, didn't he? About the feeling response to things. Yeah, being part of the impressions. Anyway, let's go on. We'll see what he's meaning by this. Perceptions of one kind seem to be, in a way, reflections of perceptions of the other kind, so that the perceptions of the mind do double duty, appearing both as impressions and ideas. When I shut my eyes and think of my study, the impressions, the ideas I form are exact representations of the impressions I felt when I was in my study. Every detail in one is to be found in the other. And I find the same resemblance and representation when I survey my other perceptions. Ideas and impressions seem always to correspond to each other. This remarkable fact holds my attention for a moment. Surveying the field more accurately, I find I have been swept along by how things first appeared to me, and that I must, with help from this simple complex distinction, limit this general thesis that all our ideas and impressions are resembling. I observe that many of our complex ideas never had impressions that corresponded to them, which is what we're just talking about. I can imagine a city such as the New Jerusalem, with golden pavements and ruby walls, though I never saw such a thing. And I observe that many of our complex impressions are never exactly copied by our ideas. I've seen Paris, but I can't form an idea of that city that perfectly represents all its streets and houses in all their detail. So I perceive that although there is in general a great resemblance between our complex impressions and ideas, it's not true across the board that they are exact copies of each other. Now, let us consider how the case stands with our simple perceptions. After the most accurate examination I'm capable of, I venture to say that here the rule holds without exception, that every simple idea has a simple impression that resembles it, and every simple impression has a corresponding idea. The idea of red that we form in the dark differs only in degree of intensity, not in nature, from the impression of red that strikes our eyes in sunshine. You can satisfy yourself that I'm right about this by going over as many of your simple impressions and ideas as you like. It's impossible to prove my point by going over all of them. But if anyone should deny this universal resemblance between simple impressions and simple ideas, I don't know how to convince him except by asking him to show a simple impression that doesn't have a corresponding simple idea, or a simple idea that has no corresponding impression. I wonder whether neuroscience would have anything to do with that, anything to say about that, whether if you imagine the colour blue, that you have similar areas in your brain getting activated as when you see the colour blue.
I can't sort of see things that you just don't have an idea of, and kind of, the mind just sort of drops them.
Such as?
Just like a lot of ordinary stuff, which is too boring to actually draw attention to the mind.
Uh-huh. So you mean you have impressions but no corresponding ideas?
Yeah.
Can you see anything here you don't have an idea of?
Like, say, the pattern on the box or something.
Pattern on the box?
You saw it all the time, but you didn't notice it.
But still...
I don't know, maybe.
This unconscious thing that the brain filter cycle is important.
Yeah.
But you still see the stuff that's not important.
Yeah, that was an interesting point, yeah.
It's an interesting experiment which they did with a case that they showed three identical twins in three cabins. But actually they showed the same person three times. So what really mattered was the contents of the cabins. Even though they told the people only to look at the girl, they then chose the girl which had a beer bottle in the cabin.
Had a what?
And liquor drink. Because then they associate liquor with farming, and they chose that girl to be the most beautiful one.
Oh, okay.
But nobody actually saw the bottle. It was just unconsciously that they chose the girl which had an alcohol bottle in her cabin rather than the girl which had flowers or decoration in there. So that influences you even if you don't know it. And that's what the commercials work on.
Okay, so let us consider what brings them into existence, impressions and ideas, which are causes and which are effects. So notice how we're moving from epistemology now to this kind of classic metaphysical inquiry into cause and effect. Full examination of this question is the subject of this book, so I shall content myself here with establishing one general proposition. All our simple ideas, when they first appear, are derived from simple impressions which correspond to them and which they exactly represent.
What about a moment of terror? You can't really hold it in your mind in the same way as you experience it when you have it.
But you have an idea about it.
It's not exactly the same.
No. I mean, you could say the same about everything. I mean, you could say the same about colours. I mean, is the colour the same? Terror. I mean, is terror simple? Is another thing. Terror is probably complex, actually, isn't it?
It's pretty simple, isn't it?
Anyway, let's move along and just see where he's leading us. As a preliminary to this first kind of phenomenon, I first go over in my mind, make myself certain of the proposition I've already asserted, connection. Okay, that every simple impression is attended with a corresponding idea, every simple idea is attended with a corresponding impression. From this constant conjunction of resembling perceptions, I immediately conclude that there is a great connection between our corresponding impressions and ideas, and the existence of one has a considerable influence on the existence of the other. Such a constant conjunction in such an infinite number of instances can't arise from chance, but clearly proves a dependence of the impressions on the ideas.
So it's saying
or of the ideas on the impressions.
So you can't see something, don't have an idea of.
Right.
And you can't have idea of something.
They have to be related in some way. There has to be some kind of causal relationship. It can't be just chance that these things are connected. Wanting to know which way the dependence runs, I consider the order in which these simple impressions and ideas first appear, and I find by constant experience that the simple impressions always come first. It is never the other way around. To give a child an idea of scarlet or orange or sweet or bitter, I present objects that are of that colour or taste. That is, I give him those impressions. I don't do anything as absurd as trying to give the child the impression by arousing him the idea. When our ideas occur, they don't produce the corresponding impressions. We don't see or any colour or feel any sensation merely by thinking of them. On the other hand, we find that every impression, whether of mind or body, is followed by an idea that resembles it in every way except its degree of force and liveliness. The constant conjunction of our resembling perceptions is a convincing proof that the one are causes of the other. And in fact, the impressions always come first is an equal proof that impressions are the causes of our ideas, not vice versa. So one-way causality from sense impression towards ideas.
What about if you're in meditation and you try to cut off the idea part? That's what the mind starts thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you reach a state like in jhana where you don't think anymore, you just perceive?
Well, that's one of the purposes, yeah, is you sort of unwinding that thing, yeah, and going back from that world of ideas, the kind of the vague world, towards what's more vivid and lively. And I find that's a very interesting part of what he's saying here, this idea of being vivid and lively, the impressions that it's on the mind. And that's part of what happens in meditation. You move towards what's vivid and lively in your mind.
Right,
exactly.
What we feel, we perceive.
Yeah.
What we perceive, we think about.
We think about, yeah.
And it forms an idea.
Yeah, yeah.
And the idea, we entangle it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we become a prisoner.
Yeah. 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 We do that.
Question on meditation.
Mm-hmm.
It will not be able to form.
Right.
And only
it will become the origin of projection. Right, right. So in Hume's language, you're sort of staying away from the ideas and coming back to the impressions, sticking with the impressions, yeah? This is confirmed by so I won't give them more argument. Okay, so this is a famous part of Hume's argument. So take the case of somebody who has had the use of his eyesight for 30 years and has become perfectly well acquainted with colours of all kinds except for one particular shade of blue, which it so happens that he's never encountered that particular shade of blue. Let all the different shades of blue, except that single one, be placed before him, descending gradually from the deepest to the lightest. Obviously, he'll perceive it first, like, you know, you're seeing a card of from paints, you know, all the different colours in the paints, and you've got to look at all the ones, and there's one missing. Obviously, he'll perceive a blank. In the sequence where that shade is missing, he'll be aware of that the qualitative gap between the neighbours is greater at that place than anywhere else in the sequence. Now, I ask, can he fill this gap from his own imagination, raising up in his mind the idea of that particular shade, even though an impression of it had never been conveyed to him by his senses? Okay, so this is a problem for Hume's philosophy. He has just told us that all ideas are derived from impressions, and especially all simple ideas have an exact correlation with their simple impressions. But here he's asking, can you have a simple impression, such as the perception of a colour, but can you have an idea about that without actually having had that impression? And Hume says, I think most people will agree that he can, and this may serve as a proof that simple ideas are not always derived from corresponding impressions, but this instance is so particular and singular that it is hardly worth noticing, and it isn't enough on its own to require us to alter our general maxim. So in other words, he's saying, he's admitted that there's an exception in his argument, but he says, well, it's not very important. So that particular point has been a major area of discussion in Hume's philosophy. Okay. So I don't want to go on too long because I want to get to some of the other things that he talks about. Okay. Subject. So he talks more about just the psychology of things, how memory works and imagination and ideas and so on, developing that situation, that idea in more detail. which is all an interesting discussion, but I just don't want to spend too long on it because there are certain ideas I want to make sure that I come to. Okay. In particular, I want to look at his notion of causality. Okay. All kinds of reasoning consists in nothing but a comparison and a discovery of the relations, constant and or changing, that two or more objects have to one another. We can make such a comparison when both the objects are present to the senses, or when neither is present, or when only one is. When both the objects are present to the senses, along with the relation that holds between them, we call this perception rather than reasoning. In this case, there's no exercise of thought, no action properly so called, but only a passive allowing in of the impressions through the organs of sensation. According to this way of thinking, we ought not to classify as reasoning any observations that we make about identity or relations of time and place, for in none of those does the mind go beyond what's immediately present to the senses, whether to discover the real existence of other objects or to discover the relations between them. Only causation produces a connection that can assure us on the basis of the existence or action of one object that some other existence or action followed or preceded it. And the other two relations, identity and location in time and space, can be used in reasoning only to the extent that they affect or are affected by causation. There is nothing in any object to persuade us that they are always distant or always close, and when from experience and observation we conclude that spatial relation doesn't promote spatial relation with identity. Not so. Okay. I'll try to get more onto what he's talking about with causation. Okay, take any pair of objects that we call cause and effect and turn them on all sides in order to find the impression that produces this prodigiously important idea. I see straight off that I mustn't search for it in any of the particular qualities of the objects. Whichever of these qualities I pick on, I find that some object that doesn't have it and yet does fall under the label of cause and effect. And indeed everything that exists, whether internally or externally, can be considered as either a cause or an effect, although it's plain that no one quality universally belongs to all beings and gives them a title to that label. You know, one quality, one might say the quality of existence, if that's a quality, but anyway. So the idea of causation, since it doesn't come from any particular quality, must be derived from some relation among objects. Okay, so he's saying that there's no one thing you can find. Everything has causal relations, but you can't find that one thing or one essence, which is that causal thing. So there must be some. It's not causality isn't a thing. It's a relation, and that relation is what we must now try to discover. The first thing I find is that only contiguous pairs of objects are considered as cause and effect related, and nothing can operate at a time or in a place other than if in extremely close to the time and place that it exists in. It sometimes seems that one object acts on another that is at a distance from it, but they are commonly found on examination to be linked by a chain of causes, with each link contiguous to the next and the end links contiguous to the distant objects. And in any particular case where we can't discover such a chain, we still presume it to exist. So we take it that contiguity is essential to causation. At least we can suppose it to be so according to the general opinion, until we find a better occasion to clear up this matter by examining what objects are and are not capable of being brought together. So things that cause are basically things that are close. Second relation that I claim to be essential to cause and effects is not so universally acknowledged, being subject to some controversy. It is relation of the cause's priority in time to the effect. Some claim that it's not absolutely necessary for a cause to precede its effect, and that any object or action can, in the very first moment of its existence, exert its productive quality, giving rise to another object or action that is absolutely simultaneous with it. But experience in most instances seems to contradict this opinion, and anyway we can establish the essentialness of the relation of priority by a kind of inference or reasoning as follows. So this one is not necessarily the same as found in Buddhist causality. In Buddhist causality, you have both the idea of sahajata paccaya, things which are born at the same time, conditioning each other. You also have the idea of the pachajata paccaya, is the subsequent condition, and the subsequent condition being something, for example, like food. Let me just explain that. I'll come back to you in just 1 second, Aya. Something like food. So you're born, you already exist, your body already exists. You take food subsequent to your existence, but that enables your continued existence. So this is this notion of pachajata paccaya. Whether it actually contradicts that explicitly, it would probably depend on your interpretation. But anyway, I think that from Buddhism and Indian philosophy, they have a more complex notion of causality than this more black and white notion of causality that Hume's talking about. Sorry, Aya, please.
Yes, one of the Abhidhamma would be called Akarna. Each man has a different mode of relationship of the being.
Right.
A phenomena.
Right.
It's very complicated, much more complicated than Hume.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And I just wonder that he ever read it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he certainly wouldn't have read it, but may have had some knowledge of it, yeah. Okay, so I'm not going to go into all of his arguments on there. Why a cause is necessary. It's a general maxim in philosophy that whatever begins to exist must be caused to do so. This is commonly taken for granted in all reasonings without any proof being given or asked for. It's supposed to be based on intuition and to be one of those immediately self-evident maxims that men can't really doubt in their hearts, even if they deny them with their lips. But if we examine this maxim in terms of the idea of knowledge that I've explained, in other words, that all of our intuitions and so on are derived from sense experience, we shan't discover it in any mark of any such intuitive certainty. Quite the contrary, we'll find that it is of a nature quite foreign to what can be known intuitively. All certainty arises from the comparison of ideas and from the discovery of such relations as don't change so long as the ideas don't change. These relations are resemblance, proportions and quantity of numbers, degrees of inequality and contrariety, none of which is involved in the proposition. Whatever has a beginning also has a cause of existence. So that proposition is not intuitively certain. At any rate, if you want to maintain that it is intuitively certain, you must deny that these four are the only four infallible relations. He goes on some more about that. Second argument, necessity of cause. Just his conclusion here, the opinion of the necessity of a cause for every new production isn't based on a priori knowledge or scientific reasoning and must therefore arise from observation and experience. Again, this empirical emphasis. The natural next question is, how does it arise from experience? But I'll postpone that question for a while because I find it more convenient to sink this question in two others. Why do we conclude that such and such a particular causes must necessarily have such and such particular effects? Why do we form an inference from cause to effect? It may turn out eventually that a single answer will serve for both questions. Again, I might skip that bit. The impressions of the senses and memory. Okay. Do, but I'm trying to look for a specific part of his argument which I want to get to before the class is finished, so I don't want to spend too much time in that part. So I apologize for this. I should have. Just, I thought it would be easy to find the actual bit that I'm looking for. Let's come back to the... I'm sorry, I can't find the passage that I'm looking for. Just have a look at his discussion of belief.
Do you subscribe to this website, or is it open?
Yes, and actually, this particular... Oh, no, this is just an open one, yeah. I just found this through Wikipedia, this document, yeah. Okay. I'm sure there was one part that I really wanted to show, but I can't necessarily find it. But let's just finish off by having a look at his discussion of personal identity, which is also very relevant in the idea of not self. Some folk philosophers believe this: we are at every moment intimately conscious of what we call ourself. We feel its existence and its continuing to exist, and are certain, more even than any demonstration can make us, both of its perfect identity and of its simplicity. The strongest sensations and most violent emotions, instead of distracting us from this view of ourselves, only focus it more intensely, making us think about how these sensations and emotions affect ourselves by bringing it pain or pleasure. To offer further evidence of the existence of oneself would make it less evident, not more, because no fact we could use as evidence is as intimately present to our consciousness as is the existence of ourself. If we doubt the latter, we can't be certain of anything. Of course, being very reminiscent of Descartes' reasoning. Unfortunately, all these forthright assertions are in conflict with the very experience that is supposed to support them. We don't so much have an idea of self of the kind that is here described. From what impression could this idea be derived? This question can't be answered without obvious contradiction and absurdity. Yet it must be answered if the idea of self is to qualify as clear and intelligible. So notice, following on from Hume's general epistemology, intelligible ideas must be derived from sense impressions. What's the sense impression of the self? We don't have one. But sense idea that self or person is not any one impression, but is rather that to which all our many impressions and our ideas are supposed to be related. If the idea of self came from an impression, it would have to be an impression that remained invariably the same throughout our lives, because the self is supposed to exist in that way. But no impression is constant and invariable. Pain and pleasure, grief and joy, passions and sensations follow one another and never all exist at the same time. So it can't be from any of these impressions or from any other that the idea of self is derived. So there is no such idea. So again, very similar to the argument you find in Buddhism, the empirical argument that, you know, you can't observe the self, all those things that you might identify the self with, and the Buddha used very similar lists of things, pain and pleasure and so on, they're constantly changing. That exact argument's found in Mahayana Sutta, among other places. Furthermore, if we retain this hypothesis about the self, what are we to say about all our particular perceptions? They're all different, distinguishable and separable from one another. They can be separately thought about and can exist separately with no need for anything to support their existence. In what way do they belong to self? How are they connected with it? And again, notice this is exactly the same as the Buddhist argument. He didn't just say these things are not self, but they don't belong to self. How do they relate to a self? For my part, when I look inward at what I call myself, when I look inward, anupassi, I always stumble on some particular perception of heat or cold, light or shade, love or hatred, pain or pleasure or the like. I never catch myself without a perception, and I never observe anything but the perception. When I'm without perceptions for a while, as in sound sleep, for that period I'm not aware of myself and can truly be said to not exist. If all my perceptions were removed by death and I could not see, I could not think, feel, see, love or hate after my body had decayed, I would be completely annihilated. I cannot see that anything more would be needed to turn me into nothing. If anyone seriously and thoughtfully claims to have a different notion of himself, I can't reason with him any longer. I have to admit that he may be right about himself as I am about myself. He may perceive something simple and continued that he calls himself, although I'm certain that there's nothing, no such thing in me. But setting aside metaphysicians of this kind, I'm willing to affirm of the rest of mankind. So he's kind of slightly sarcastic tone, which is kind of, well, you know, if you're a philosopher, you can convince yourself that to live in this fantasy world, but ordinary people find it impossible to do so. I'm willing to affirm the rest of mankind that each of us is nothing but a bundle or collection or khanda, perhaps, of different perceptions that follow each other enormously quickly and are in a perpetual flux and movement. So we've got anicca and anatta here. Our eyes can't turn in their sockets without varying our perceptions. Our thought is even more variable than our sight. Yeah, again, the Buddhist idea that the mind is faster than everything else. All our other senses and faculties contribute to this change in our perceptions, with no one of them remaining unaltered for a moment. The mind is a kind of stage on which many perceptions successively make their appearance. They pass back and forth, glide away, and mingle in an infinite variety of positions and situations. Strictly speaking, there is no simplicity in the mind at one time and no identity through different times, no matter what natural inclination we may have to imagine that simplicity and identity. That is to say, it is not strictly true that when a blue colour is seen and a whistling sound heard at the same time, one single unified mind has both these perceptions. Nor is it strictly true that the mind that has a certain perception at one time is the very same mind that has a perception at another time. The stage comparison must not mislead us. What constitutes the mind is just the successive perceptions. So he's saying, don't take the metaphor too seriously. Well, because the mind is just these successive perceptions, nothing else. We haven't the faintest conception of the place where these scenes are represented or of the materials of which it's composed. What then makes us so inclined to ascribe an identity to these successive perceptions and to suppose that we have an invariable and uninterrupted existence through the whole course of our lives? To answer this question, we must distinguish what we think and imagine about our personal identity from the role of personal identity in our emotions and desires. The former is our present subject. To explain it perfectly, we must dig fairly deep. First, we must account for the identity that we attribute to plants and animals, because there's a great analogy between that and the identity of a self or person. We have a clear idea of an object that remains invariable and uninterrupted while time supposedly passes. We call this the idea of identity or sameness. We also have a clear idea of many different objects existing successively in a close relation to one another, and this, properly understood, is just as good an example of diversity as it would be if the objects were not related to one another in any way. As the sand runs through the hourglass, this grain is distinct from that one that falls a tenth of a second later and a micromillimeter behind. They are diverse from one another, which is simply to say that they are two grains, not one, and the fact that they are closely related to one another in space, in time, and in being alike makes no difference to that. They are as distinct from one another, they are as clearly two as the Taj Mahal and the Grand Canyon. But though these two ideas of identity and a sequence of related objects are perfectly distinct from one another and even contrary, yet in our everyday thinking they're often confused with one another, treated as though they were the same. I will now explain what leads to that confusion. Here are two mental activities. One, thinking about a sequence of related objects, and two, thinking about one uninterrupted and invariable object. Okay, so notice these two things. Essentially, those two kinds of thinking is the difference between the Buddhist thinking about the self or the person and the Hindu thinking. Yeah? So this is the Atman thinking, one uninterrupted invariable object, and this is the Buddhist idea, a sequence of related objects. Although these are distinct and involve different activities of the imagination, they feel the same. The activity in one doesn't require much more effort than the activity in two. In one, the relation between the objects helps the mind to move easily from one to the next, making its mental journey as smooth as if it were contemplating one continued object, as in two. This resemblance between the two kinds of thought generates the confusion in which you mistakenly substitute the notion of two identity for that of one related object. I'm not entirely convinced by that. It seems to me a slightly shallow explanation of that. It seems more that from a Buddhist point of view, this whole idea of attachment, the reason why we think that we're the same is more to do with attachment and fear and so on, rather than merely a sort of perceptual grease that makes it more convenient to think about it. So he then brings our only way to get out of this oscillation between truth and error is to give into the error and boldly assert that these different related objects are really the same, even though they are interrupted and variable. To justify this absurdity to ourselves, we often feign some new and unintelligible thing that connects the objects together and prevents them from being interrupted and variable. And that's actually a very good insight, that when all of these different things, we imagine something, call it God, call it the soul, call it, say, in 19th century science, the ether. Yeah, all of these things, we invent something and say there must be something that connects it. The perceptions of our senses are intermittent, there are gaps, but we disguise this by feigning that they exist continuously and they vary, but we disguise this by bringing in the notion of a soul or self or substance, which stays the same under all the variation. Even in contexts where we don't indulge in such fictions, we are so strongly inclined to confuse identity with relatedness that we are apt to imagine something unknown and mysterious connecting the parts other than the relations between them, and this is what I think happens when we ascribe identity to plants. When even this kind of fiction making doesn't take place, we are still impelled to confuse these ideas with one another, even though we can't give a satisfactory account of what we are doing or find anything invariable and uninterrupted to justify our notion of identity. So again, essentially, he's saying that the notion of identity, that the reality as we perceive is always variable and changing, and identity is essentially is a delusion. So he talks more about identity and continuity.
So this, I'll just have one last bit. He's, okay, so here's 7, recapping or giving 7 arguments on this topic. Number one, when we talk of self or substance, we must associate ideas with these terms, otherwise they'd be meaningless. Every idea is derived from previous impressions, and we have no impression of self or a substance as something simple and individual. Therefore, we have no idea of them in that sense. So this is one of his critiques of the self. We've already heard that one. Whatever is distinct is distinguishable, and whatever is distinguishable is separable by the thought or imagination. All perceptions are distinct, they are therefore distinguishable and separable, and may be thought of as separately existent, or they may exist separately without any contradiction or absurdity. When I view this table and that chimney, nothing is present to me but particular perceptions that are of the same kind as all other perceptions. This is the doctrine of philosophers. But this table and that chimney can and do exist separately. This is the doctrine of the common man, and it implies no contradiction. So there is no contradiction in extending the same doctrine to all perceptions. That is the doctrine that they can exist separately. The next paragraph gives an argument for this. All ideas are borrowed from previous perceptions, so ideas of objects are derived from that source. So a proposition that is intelligible with regard to objects must be equally so in regard to perception, but it is intelligible and consistent to say that objects exist independently without having to adhere in any common simple substance. So it can't be observed to say the same thing about perceptions. We are therefore not entitled to insist that there must be some self or substance in which our perceptions exist. So this is an anti-substantialist idea. And notice that again, the parallel in Buddhist philosophy, that this was one of the critiques that Nagarjuna had of the Abhidhamma, that the idea that it's not just a self, not just an Atman that he was looking at, but also the Sabhava, that there's a substance underlying things. And this was the basis of Nagarjuna's critique of the Abhidhamma philosophy. And Hume, in accordance with that, is saying we have just as little basis for saying that there's some kind of substance underlying sense perception as we do for saying that there is a self underlying the diversity of experience. When I look in on myself, I can never perceive this self without some one or more perceptions, nor can I ever perceive anything but the perceptions. It's a complex of these perceptions, therefore, that constitutes the self. We can conceive a thinking being to have as few perceptions as we like. Let's reduce to be the level below an oyster of having only one perception, such as that of thirst or hunger. In considering such a mind, do you conceive anything more than merely that one perception? Have you any notion of self or substance? If not, the addition of other perceptions can never give you that notion. You know, so in other words, if you have even one, if the self is derived from perception, then even one perception would give you rise to the self. The annihilation that some people suppose to follow on death, and which entirely destroys this self, is nothing but an extinction of all particular perceptions, love and hatred, pain and pleasure, thought and sensation. So these must be the same as the self, since the one cannot survive the other. Is self the same as substance? If it is, then there can be no question of the same self remaining when there is a change of substance. If, on the other hand, self and substance are distinct, what is the difference between them? For my part, I have no notion of either when they're conceived as distinct from particular perceptions. Philosophers are beginning to be reconciled to the principle that we have no idea of external substance distinct from the ideas of particular qualities. This should pave the way for a similar principle regarding the mind, namely that we have no notion of it distinct from the particular perceptions. All of this seems clear and true. But having started my account with our particular perceptions all loose and separate, when I proceed to explain the principle of connection that binds them together, making us attribute to them a real simplicity and identity, I come to realize that my account is very defective and that I wouldn't have accepted it if it weren't for the seeming power of the foregoing arguments. In short, there are two principles I can not render consistent, nor can I give either of them up. All our distinct perceptions are distinct existences, and two, the mind never perceives any real connection among distinct existences. If our perceptions either inhered in something simple or individual, or if the mind perceives some real connection among them, there would be no difficulty. For my part, I must plead the privilege of a skeptic and confess that this problem is too hard for my understanding. I don't say outright that it's absolutely insoluble. Perhaps someone else, or even myself, after further reflection, will discover some hypothesis that will reconcile those contradictions. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, this problem of being able to infer from perception to whether things actually exist or not. I wanted to have a... one of the passages that I wanted to find that I didn't come across was... he talks about... and I'm not, it might not even be in this book. I am frightened and confused by the forlorn solitude in which my philosophy places me and see myself as some strange, uncouth monster who, not being able to mingle and unite in society, has been expelled from all human society and left utterly abandoned and disconsolate. I would like to run into the crowd for shelter and warmth, but I can't get myself to mix with such deformity. Everyone keeps it serious, isn't it? Yeah.
When
they
come back to the point of what he said about the causes, if we can only know the impressions,
yep.
Then his argument for cause, I couldn't really understand it. Was it that he just thinks that it's something intuitive that there is a cause, or he doesn't believe that there is a cause?
Yeah, I think that yes, I think that's precisely the issue. I think he suggests or he argues that there's no such thing as cause. But how necessarily consistent that he is and how successful he is one of the great issues and great problems with Hume's philosophy. Just to see if there's a discussion, that was one of the things I wanted to look at in more detail in it. Just one quote from him which I always remember was that he said something along the lines that he said that, you know, you can have this idea of that there's no self and that there's nothing but all these different perceptions and it's all changing and all of those kinds of things. And you can be fully convinced of the truth of that argument, but I guarantee you that 5 minutes later you'll be making yourself a cup of tea and you'll completely have forgotten about that and you'll be regarding everything as consisting of wholes and identities and persons and selves just as you were before. And I think, and that's a very kind of interesting kind of admission, and the difference there, specifically the difference between what he's saying in Buddhism, of course, is mindfulness, is sati, yeah, to remember, to actually have that practice, to be able to bear that in mind constantly, which is that's the point of difference. Now, I am just trying to find a summary. There was a summary of Hume's, that particular philosophical point that you're asking about, Aya, which can maybe give a more clear idea than I can give off the top of my head. Let's see what it says about causation. The notion of causation is close, so this is just from Wikipedia, closely linked to the problem of induction. According to Hume, we reason inductively by associating constantly conjoined events, and it's the mental act of association that is the basis of our concept of causation. Okay, so again, you don't, causation is not an impression, it's not something you see through the senses or experience directly, it's something which is inferred by induction. There are three main interpretations of Hume's theory of causation presented in the literature: the logical positivist, the skeptical realist, and the quasi-realist. The kinder realist. Sort of realist. Yeah, he's sort of realist. The logical positive interpretation is that Hume analyzes causal propositions such as A caused B in terms of regularities in perception. A caused B is equivalent to whatever A type events happen, B type events follow, where whatever, whenever, refers to all possible perceptions. B power and necessity are qualities of perceptions, not of objects, felt by the soul and not perceived externally in objects. This view, so this interpretation of Hume, is rejected by skeptical realists who argue that Hume thought that causation amounts to more than just the regular succession of events, when two events are causally conjoined, a necessary connection underpins the conjunction. So that first one is the most skeptical, right? So that's saying that there's no such thing as causation, all there is correlation. Skeptical realists say no, Hume didn't really argue that. Shall we rest contented with these two relations of contiguity and succession as affording a complete idea of causation? By no means. There is a necessary connection to be taken into consideration. Quote from Hume. Hume held that we have no perceptual access to this necessary connection, hence skepticism, but we are naturally compelled to believe in its objective existence, ergo realism. He thus concluded that there are no necessary connections, only constant conjunctions. Referring to the law of causality, Hume wrote, I never asserted so absurd as a proposition as that something could arise without a cause. It has been argued, and so then the third proposition, the quasi-realist proposition, it's been argued that while Hume did not think that causation is reducible to pure regularity, he was not a fully-fledged realist either. Simon Blackburn calls this a quasi-realist reading. On this view, talk about causal necessity is an expression of a functional change in the human mind, whereby certain events are predicted or anticipated on the basis of prior experience. The expression of causal necessity is a projection of the functional change onto the objects involved in the causal connection. In other Hume's words, nothing is more usual than to apply to external bodies every internal sensation which they occasion. Okay, so that's a more kind of nuanced reading than either of the previous ones, which is invoking our psychological relationship with things. And I think that last one to me sounds more in line with what Hume was saying, and I think more in line with what the Buddha was saying, that it's not about do these things actually exist out in the world or not, but it's about what is our relation to those things as perceiving subjects, because that's all we can ever know. So the question is, does cause actually objectively inhere in the world is kind of an irrelevant question. It's how it actually works in your mind that is the critical thing. I think so, something like that, yeah.
But there's something about life and death.
Yeah.
So if you have life and death,
yeah,
it's regardless of how we relate to
them. Is it? If you don't have any awareness of life and death.
And kind of a life and a God, how I relate to the end of life and death,
mm-hmm,
is not really the end of life and death.
Again, that's the kind of realist argument. But it affects you, right? Whether you're aware of that answer, life and death, affects you, and that's all we can ever know is what actually affects us. The ant might have a different perception, but we can't talk about that. And we can talk about it, but we can't know what that is. So you have a particular perception of that ant walking along and getting crushed by a foot. Somebody else has another perception of it. Somebody else has another perception. We have other perceptions of these similar kinds of things, and we put them all together in the mind. But the act of putting them all together in the mind to understand them is something that's only done in minds. It's only done out by our relationship with that sense impression. It's not something that objectively exists in the universe. I think so, yes. Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, that he's an empiricist. He's pointing to sense perception. He starts out with an epistemological argument. What do we know? And his whole argument is based on what we know.
So, like, if you had, you know, squashed that ant,
mm-hmm,
So in your mind, when you're related to it, these two contiguous events are causally related.
Right.
You squash
it. Shoe and ant.
But what if the ant has this like mini baby ant heart attack?
Exactly, yeah.
You didn't know that.
Right.
But that could have actually been the real cause. But it doesn't matter, because in your mind, you relate to it only based on what you know.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah. And we're, you know, we're fooled by these things all the time. I mean, that's what magicians make a living from, isn't it? By confusing the conjunction of things. You know, they put one thing next to another and you assume that that's causing it, but actually there's something else which is happening behind the scenes. Yeah. So, and just one more briefly, we've seen before that Hume talks about the self as a bundle. And the standard interpretation is that he was a bundle theorist. Cool, that would be a great name for a band, actually. The bundle theorists, yeah. Who held that the self is nothing but a bundle of experiences linked by the relations of causation and resemblance, or more accurately, the empirically warranted idea of a self is just the idea of such a bundle. However, some philosophers have criticized the bundle theory interpretation of Hume on personal identity. They argue that distinct selves can have perceptions that stand in relations of similarity and causality with one another. Thus, perceptions must already come parceled into distinct bundles before they can be associated according to the relations of similarity and causality. In other words, the mind must already possess a unity that cannot be generated or constituted by these relations alone. Since the bundle theory interpretation portrays Hume as answering an ontological question, philosophers who see Hume as not very concerned with such questions have queried whether the view is really Hume's or only a decoy. Instead, it suggests that Hume might have been answering an epistemological question about the causal origin of our concept of the self. In the appendix to the treatise, Hume declares himself dissatisfied with his account of the self in Book 1 of the treatise, and the question of why he's dissatisfied has received a number of different answers. So this is just one of the things about Hume's thought and his writing, that that treatise, which is his most important book, which he was just reading from, it was written early in his life, and he wrote a number of things afterwards, and he said that in some places he said that he questioned or changed some of his ideas, and so it's a valid topic of inquiry as to what extent those things have been changed, although generally speaking the academic consensus is that he revised more the manner of his discussion rather than the content of his philosophy. Didn't change very particular to any great degree. Another interpretation of Hume's view of the self has been argued for by James Giles. According to this view, Hume is not arguing for a bundle theory, which is a form of reductionism, but rather for an eliminative view of the self. Rather than reducing the self to a bundle of perceptions, Hume's rejecting the idea of the self altogether. On this interpretation, Hume's proposing a no-self theory, and thus has much in common with Buddhist thought. Alison Gopnik has argued, as we've seen, that Hume was in a position to learn about Buddhist thought during his time in France in the 1730s. So this is, you know, it is an interesting thing, and something like not-self, you know, you could imagine that in a philosophical discussion, even if he wasn't necessarily very well versed in the whole Buddhist ideas about not-self and why the Buddha taught it, but it's very possible that the idea would have cropped up, yeah, and the Jesuit would have said, you know, there's these weird Buddhists in this kind of strange country over there where they eat this kind of smelly food and stuff, and they talk about this idea of not-self, you know, as if there's nothing there other than what you perceive, you know, what a weird idea, and then Hume's like, oh, actually...
If you read one of the very famous books, it's called in Mahayana Buddhism, but for the Mahayana meditation, it's called the Sudangama Sutta. Who knows?
Is what, sir?
When we perceive,
who knows?
We perceive. And there must be something consistently here to perceive it. It's not similar to the Pabangajita you mentioned in Abhidhamma Sutta.
Yes, 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 many different interpreters, I don't know about the argument of the Shakyamuni Kendra.
Well, if the connection was with Thai Buddhism directly, then that would explain that. Yeah. Anyway, I think all of us can see, you know, there are those similarities there. And you know, certainly it's possible that there was some influence. Okay, so that's it. That's David Hume.
So going back to the ant.
The ant, yeah.
So
there's these two.
I was mainly asking that it was life that caused death, rather than objective. It was because it was alive. That has to be a cause for the death, regardless.
So it's a necessary condition.
So in terms of necessary condition, in that sense, then how does he kind of consider all these cases?
Probably have to go and look in more detail at the, because he gave a lot of examples in the treatise. I would say from that point of view is that life, from Hume's point of view, is life would be a complex idea, right? It's not reducible to any particular simple thing. So life then isn't closely derived from any particular sense impression. Well, that would be one thing, and just observation and so on, but there's no one thing. Like, you know, he's talking before, you can't see one quality that distinguishes, you know, that can isolate it. So if you ask what's one quality of living things, it's kind of hard to point to one quality that would characterize living things. So you've got a notion of things being alive, which itself is a complex notion and must be inferred from multiple perceptions, multiple sense impressions. So any inference about it is based on a generalization from those sense impressions. So he would say it's kind of vague and unclear, rather than being something which is real and distinct. It almost comes back to that first example of deductive reasoning that we talked about. You know, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Actually, Socrates' mortality is something you can observe very clearly and distinctly. I mean, if you were in the room with him at the time, or even if you just read the account of his death, it's actually very clear and distinct. It's described in a lot of detail. Whereas all men are mortal is something you can't observe clearly and distinctly. It's a very abstract notion. So the same with that idea that all life must, you know, you die because you're alive. It's something which is actually quite abstract and quite derived from a sort of complex patterns of sense impressions, rather than being something you can see directly.
Because you say you're alive because you die. It's like a chicken and the egg thing.
It is, yes, yeah. And that again would come back to that notion of causality, whether things have to be conditioned by things that happened before or after them. Yeah, you can say that death is also a condition for life. One of the distinctions between the Buddhist view and the Humean view, and I think this is essential for understanding that. Hume's views on causality have been very controversial. They're quite disturbing, And, you know, like this idea of not self, you know, it's like you're kind of really pulling the rug out from underneath things. There's no substance in the world. There's no actual connection between things. All there is... And so it's kind of... You always kind of want to try to buttress it up. Now, one of the problems with what Hume's saying is that, you know, you can destroy, you can pull everything apart, but, like, what's the point of it at the end of the day, right? I mean, actually, Hume had a lot of positive impact in terms of the development of science and these kinds of things. But from a Buddhist point of view, the point of it is much clearer, is that the reason you're investigating things is to let go of attachment. And by letting go of attachment, then you let go of suffering and you find freedom. So that's the purpose. So from a Buddhist point of view, it doesn't matter so much whether these things are objectively true or not. What matters is that you get free from them. Yeah? So it's contemplating in that way allows you to let go of them. That's the crucial point. It's not whether contemplating in that way gives you direct insight into the truth. That's a means, that's not the end. The end of it is freedom. So it's more of a pragmatic theory of truth.
I think Hume was very influenced by Buddhist ideas of causality.
Sorry?
How come it doesn't feel like Hume was influenced by Buddhist ideas of causality?
Why do you say that?
Because I would think that Buddhist perspective that there's clear causality, clear cause and effect.
I don't think there is. In fact, I think that the Buddhist idea of causality is the Humean idea of causality. Yeah.
It's just a random contiguous event?
No, it's not a random contiguous event. It's a pattern that you observe. So you observe the pattern of things that happen. You don't observe the hidden connections between them. Well, this is something that they talk about in Brahmanical philosophy, that there's like sandhis. So in Brahmanical philosophy, like when you did a ritual, you do like a horse sacrifice or something like that, and every word, every motion, every act that you do is like a line that connects it with something in the cosmos. Everything has a resemblance to something else. Everything has these causal connections with everything else. So from a Buddhist point of view, the Buddha said, imasmin sati idang hoti, imasupada idang upajati. Yeah? This being, that is. This arising, that arises. Yeah? So what you're doing is you observe the actual arising of things. In Hume's terminology, you could say you observe the impressions. So you say, imasmin sati idang hoti, I observe a sense contact, and then I observe a feeling. That arises after that. Yeah? That's what you actually observe. You don't observe that sense contact causing the feeling. You just observe one and then you observe the other.
But isn't the way it's phrased with dependent origination that because this factor is so, that and that, there's the conjunction so...
He's still using the words, but what the actual philosophical implications of it are is another matter, how you interpret it. Yeah. So when he specifically explained what the actual meaning of dependent origination, that's with the idapateta, imasmin sati idam huti, this being, that is. Due to the arising of this, that arises. Again, the word due to is just an ablative form, out of, following from.
So you mean the Buddha never actually say that caused that?
Yes. He does, but I mean, there's a difference between using a word in that and what the precise philosophical implications of it are. Yes, I mean, it's like he used the word self all the time, but it depends in what actual sense that he meant that. So what I'm suggesting is that when he talked about causality, that what he didn't talk about the actual underlying metaphysical causal thing which you can somehow never, which is there but is somehow never observed, which is what they're talking, what this second argument here is talking about, the necessary one here, that you have no you have no perceptual access to the necessary connection, but you're naturally compelled to believe in its objective existence. That's what I'm talking about here. I'm saying that you this part is absolutely true. You don't have a perceptual access to the necessary connection. That all you see is the things happening. You don't see this causing that. You just see one thing happening and you see another thing happening. And so this is just an inference. You know? So again, just to take an example, you know, if I say an example, if I move that along the table, that cup hits that jug and it causes that sound. Right? Yeah? And I can keep on doing that and it'll keep on making that sound. Now in fact, I anticipated this question. I recorded earlier another sound. And I made this jug specially out of sound dampening materials. It doesn't make any noise whatsoever. And every time you see that going there, it's just making a sound. And there's actually nothing happening. So again, what I would say from a Buddhist point of view is all you observe, your sense impression, is you observe light. You hear sound. And the notion of cause is something that you infer. But all you really can say is that that pattern occurs regularly. Yeah? That's all you can say. The pattern occurs regularly. In philosophy, they say correlation doesn't imply causation. Whereas I think causation is nothing more than correlation. It's nothing more than correlation for which you haven't found an exception yet.
Wasn't the inner sufferer with what underlying causality exists or does not exist?
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
So what's the point of actually one sort of it's ontological?
It's just seems like fancy, like mental gymnastics.
No, it's not fancy. The point of it is that this idea that there are really, truly, really existing causes is fundamental in Theravada and Abhidhamma. So in Theravadan philosophy, these things are all sabhava. So they all actually exist. They're all substance, in the word that Hume was using before. They actually really objectively exist.
So now, is it useful if you hold one of those philosophies of truly really existent?
Not just if you hold to them, but we're living in a Buddhist culture where people who do believe these things are teaching about these things all the time. And so you regularly hear people talk about based on these assumptions. Well, I mean, according to the Abhidhamma philosophy, is that all the dhammas exist and they're real, and all the conditions exist and they're real, like the 24 conditions in the Patthana. So they're actually really existing things. They objectively exist.
And so they cause each other.
And they cause each other, yeah. Well, I don't believe it's true.
Yeah.
I don't think they actually do exist. But a lot of the different ways that Vipassana meditation is taught, it's based on seeing these things. So you have to see the existence of the things that actually truly really exist in the Abhidhamma. That's the basis of all the Burmese Vipassana techniques. Right. They don't necessarily phrase it that way because they're talking to people who they assume aren't necessarily interested in the philosophical underpinnings, but that's the philosophical underpinning of all Burmese Vipassana meditation systems. These things really, truly, really exist, and the job of your Vipassana is to see them. And only when you've actually seen them can you let go of them. And I don't think that's true. I don't think that's what the Buddha is talking about.
Rather than being statement of actual truth of the reality.
there's no causality.
Well, maybe a bit of both, I don't know.
Maybe it's like causality, unknowable quality.
I would say so, yeah. I'd say that in that deep sense, I think that causation is, it's a metaphysical statement. Like I said, and again, this essentially was Nagarjuna's argument against the Abhidhamma people, that they've replaced the idea of a self with all of these philosophical notions, which are as in themselves ultimately just as unknowable as a self is. What? Nagarjuna and Melinda, sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry.
What are you asking?
Who?
Oh, you're talking about Nagasena. Yeah, Nagarjuna, yeah. Yeah, Nagarjuna, Nagasena. Yeah. Yeah, so that was basically one of Nagarjuna's arguments. He argued against the notion of causality apart from everything else. I haven't read his book. We have a copy here, but yeah.
I think you can. He had a lot of talk in his YouTube. It's striking that he doesn't break the Buddhism, but what he thought, it exactly lies in Chan meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just wonder that people may come down different way of practice, but they come to the same insight.
Right? Yeah.
Will we have a
ready
class in 15 minutes?
Let's give it till 7:15. A ready class 7:15. Okay, let's just finish my time respects.